It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And everyone knows from the news about separation of children from their parents at the border, no matter how you feel about it. But there's another form of family separation happening in New York City that has nothing to do with child immigration and more to do with child poverty. WNYC reporter for crime and policing Yasmin Khan has a new story highlighting the frequency with which kids are taken from parents when the city's child welfare agency suspects a child is in danger. Here is Emma Ketteringham from the legal aid group, the Bronx Defenders, from Yaz's story. She represents some of the parents, this lawyer does, and she says that the city does this too often, traumatizing kids, parents, and the communities they belong to.
The law does not say remove to be on the safe side. The law says you remove when a child is in imminent danger of serious harm. And the reason why the law says that is because of the harm we inflict every time we do it. And we need to make sure that we only do it when it is absolutely necessary.
Emma Ketteringham leads the family defense practice at the Bronx Defenders. Yasmin Khan's story is titled Family Separation in Our Midst. Hi, Yas.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What's the city's standard for removing a child from a parent?
Well, what the standard that Emma was just describing is, and is the focus of my story, is actually on emergency removals. So the city, when they feel like they need to remove a child for safety reasons at home, they have to get court oversight. They have to file a petition in family court and get approval from a judge, except for when they believe that a child is in imminent danger of serious harm. So even when court is closed, if the city determines that a child is in imminent danger, they can use their discretion and remove a child without a court order. And that is happening nearly half the time that the city is removing children. And that proportion has actually gone up over the past 5 years.
How does the city's enforcement practice then reflect or depart from the policy on paper?
Well, I mean, I interviewed a number of parents that to me, you know, I'm getting their side of the story. To me and to their attorneys and to them, they don't believe that there was an emergency. You know, these are called emergency removals because it's supposed to happen in an emergency. You know, one mother featured in my story, one of my stories, had her child removed because of an issue of inadequate housing. Another mother because of an issue related to a positive marijuana test. And it's not saying that things are perfect at home or there might not need to be an intervention or that there might not need to be a removal, but it really targets the city's discretion. The legal standard, again, for using emergency powers is imminent danger to the child's life or health, which is deliberately a very high standard.
One of the parents who you interviewed was Tonya Lovell. And she's one of the mothers featured in your story who we have a clip of. Here's 18 seconds of her in her own words.
Please forgive Mama, but I'm going to get you. I'm going to come and get you back. And I'm telling my child this, and he's so heartbroken. It felt like you're just going to have a baby and somebody just rip your child out your womb. That's how I felt.
What happened in Tonya's case?
Tonya's case, she was staying with her brother. She had applied twice to get into shelter, actually. It was just her and her daughter. She has an 18-month-old at that time. She had an 18-month-old at that time. She was staying with her brother, and I'll skip this sort of crazy backstory, but an ACS worker, a child protective specialist, came to the door, saw a really sort of messy situation at home, and decided that her daughter, Tonya's daughter, Eliana, was not safe in that house, nor was she safe in her mother's care, that Tonya Lovell had shown poor parental judgment by keeping Eliana in that house, even though she had already applied to get into shelter, but she had been rejected by the Department of Homeless Services, presumably because she had a roof over her head. So where one city agency is saying, you know, your housing is okay not to get a spot in a shelter, another city agency is saying, this housing is not okay and we're going to take your child away.
A classic catch-22, and they took her child away. They took Eliana away at 18 months. Where was she taken?
She was taken to a holding site, a temporary residence for children before they're placed in foster care, and then was actually placed in a foster home. This all happened over the course of one weekend. And then when Tonya went to court, the first court hearing, the judge returned Eliana to Level's care and ordered ACS to get them into shelter.
Listeners, I wonder if anybody has any stories along these lines. It's a very specific thing that doesn't happen to that many people, but it happens to more people than a lot of people might think. An emergency removal by the Administration for Children's Services by the City of New York that maybe was done under questionable circumstances, or we can broaden it to any parent who happens to be listening who's had a child removed. We know this is a big thing. We've covered this in the past, this question of whether the city is too aggressive in removing children from their homes and the racial disparities in this. 212-433-WNYC. If you've been involved on any side of this, or if you've known anybody who has, 212-433-WNYC. How about any ACS caseworkers? How do you make this judgment? Help us report this story based on your experience as a caseworker. I'm sure it's one of the most excruciating decisions that you would ever have to make, because nobody presumably removes a child from their parents' home lightly, and yet you're not there every day. You don't see everything that's going on. How do you decide on whether to even ask a court for permission to remove a child? And if you've ever been involved in an emergency situation where you felt you couldn't even wait to ask a court, how did you assess the situation and decide which side to err on, caseworkers? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I asked Mayor de Blasio about Yaz's story on Friday and this idea that there may be too many emergency removals taking place and maybe not enough consideration for the risks to the child from that, in addition to the risks of leaving the child there. And here's part of what the mayor said.
I appreciate Yasmin's report because this is an issue I care about a lot. First and foremost, care about the safety of children. I've seen and you've seen cases where we lost kids, and sometimes, I'm talking about over the last 20, 30 years in the city, there have been some absolutely painful, horrible cases. And we learned from all those that you have to be assertive and not take the chance. If our investigators believe a child is in immediate danger, they're not going to hesitate, and they're not going to come back, the following Monday or something like that, and God forbid we've lost a kid. So I think there is an aggressive approach.
Mayor de Blasio here on Friday. Yes, did you feel heard, or what does his thinking reflect?
Yeah, so his thinking reflects the narrative of the whole system, and even nationally, that the idea, the number one priority is child safety. He raised the issue of child deaths and this idea of preventing the worst case scenario. And that is a very compelling argument. It's hard to argue with that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have now is a system where we're applying that thinking of preventing cases that are really very rare to a whole system of families that are charged with neglect because of a lot of issues related to poverty. We've decided that having inadequate housing is child neglect, that having not enough food in the house is child neglect, that missing school is child neglect. And these are all issues, for sure, where families might need help, but they might not warrant the level of intervention that that is really baked into this whole system.
So do you think the risks of removal, as opposed to the protection offered by removal at a given moment, at least as seen by the caseworkers or the court, the risks of removal are underestimated by child welfare?
I think the leadership of ACS understands the risks of removal. And I spoke to, child protective specialists, those folks on the ground, who, told me that absolutely removal is a last resort, that they weigh that risk, that harm, when they're making the calculation of whether to remove a child. And And I will say that the city's removals have gone down overall, especially when you compare it to decades ago when we had almost 50,000 kids in foster care.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yes. However, you know, I don't think that we really had a full understanding, just the global we, you know, until we are now fresh off of a conversation nationally of the harm of removal after seeing this on the border. And we don't see it at all in New York City because it is only affecting, I shouldn't say only, it is primarily affecting poor families of color. And it's not happening in a dramatic way in the news like it was on the border last summer, last spring. But it is happening to families repeatedly and is really affecting generations of families in our city.
Has it gone down or up or neither?
It's gone
down.
During
de Blasio's time in office in particular?
Well, I will say that removals, overall removals have gone down. And they always spike in reports to the state register of abuse and neglect, always spike after a high-profile death or an after high-profile abuse cases. But the reason why I was especially interested in looking at emergency removals is that, say, from 2014 to 2017, even though overall removals in the city went down, the proportion of emergency removals, where the city uses its own discretion to remove without going to court first, went up. And the city did not have a very good explanation as to why that would be, other than, you know, intake reports have gone up. But it couldn't explain the rate to me. It didn't say to me, well, we're removing less, but the cases that we're seeing involve, you know, more abuse or more severe neglect. They never had a response to me for that.
Stuart in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with our reporter Yasmin Khan. Hi, Stuart.
How you doing?
Okay.
I wanted to let you know, Brian, that a good friend of mine, a couple years ago, black guy, by the way, and that may be relevant, had his six-year-old son removed from his custody because he failed a marijuana urine test. Nothing more than that. They put his son in foster care, and he had to go through weekly tests for a year until he could finally get his son back. And during that year, the foster mother, who was so corrupt, contacted my friend and asked that if he gave her money, he would let her see his son, which I guess was against the rules or something like that.
I just thought
that was an interesting anecdote, Brian.
Stuart, thank you very much. Well, Stuart brings up marijuana.
Yeah.
And as a cause for removal, and this is part of your story, right?
This is a large part of my story. In fact, one of the moms featured in the second part of the radio series had her newborn removed after the newborn tested positive for marijuana at birth. And this was a mother who had a previous case of child neglect, which could have factored in also. You know, and the mayor was very adamant that marijuana, you should never factor into a removal.
We have that clip. Since you brought it up, I did ask the mayor about that part of your reporting, and here's 30 seconds of what he said.
We agree, as a matter of policy, that the use of marijuana alone is not grounds for removal. That's the policy, and the policy should be followed by our ACS employees. Now, I don't have an indication it's not being followed. I'll certainly ask that question. We'll look into that for sure. We're going to take this report by WNYC very seriously. But I want everyone to understand, so there's no confusion, the policy is clear. That alone is not grounds for removal.
So I want to just take this a little bit further and make clear that actually a positive marijuana test is not grounds for a case of child neglect at all. Removal aside, that is state law, that is ACS's policy, and it is the policy of Health and Hospitals Corporation not to report a positive test alone unless there is other collateral information that a parent cannot adequately care for his or her child.
A positive test on the parent. That one story was about a positive test on the newborn.
That's right. And newborns as well. It's the a pediatrician can decide to test a newborn, but they, according to, you know, testimony just a couple of weeks ago at the city council, the chief medical officer of Health and Hospitals testified that a positive marijuana test alone for either the mother or the baby is not grounds for a report of child neglect.
So based on your reporting, is that policy not being followed?
That policy is not being followed. Whether it's in a very small handful of cases, it's hard to know, but it does seem like a pretty good area to target. You know, it's existing policy. It seems like a good area that, you know, Health and Hospitals can tighten. There are even issues around consent, the way that they get consent. There's nothing written that's given to to pregnant mothers when they're being tested. They are allowed to not give consent. There's no written consent that's obtained either. It's just, you know, conversation between doctor and mother. So certainly, I feel like if there's anywhere that the city can put heads together between the mayor, ACS, and health and hospitals, that is one area that they could tighten.
My guest for another few minutes is WNYC's Yasmeen Khan, whose multi-part story is titled Family Separation in Our Midst, about emergency removals, as they're called, of children from their parents by city child welfare workers. Emergency removals being those that are done where the children are taken away without going to a court first and making a case that it's necessary. And the question being raised is, are there too many emergency removals, which Yaz reports are not going down, while removals in general are going down, too many emergency removals out of bias or misunderstanding the law or the rules or best practices or any other reason. Phyllis in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Over 20 years ago, the younger brother of an elementary school friend of my daughter's was taken away on an emergency basis from his parents because he had a concussion. He had fallen and hit his head. He was literally the rambunctious boy who got injured a lot in the playground. And he was taken away on an emergency basis, we're pretty sure, because he was a Latino kid and his parents were Latino. And it wasn't until the entire school community rose up and wrote letters to ACS, which was called something else at the time. Another school parent who was a pediatrician wrote letters on behalf of the family, and eventually the child was given back to the family. But two decades later, it's still traumatic.
And did you tell our screener that you thought racial bias was involved?
I did, and we did think that. I think that if this had been a middle-class white family, ACS or whatever it was called back in 1998, might not have acted quite so quickly. But they just snatched that boy away from his parents, and it was terrible. It was just terrible.
Phyllis, thank you very much. Where does racial bias, explicit or implicit, come into your story?
I mean, I think the fact that there is racism at play is undeniable in a system that almost only includes families of color. Even in terms of initial reports that the city investigates, it's less than 10% of children are white. And that number gets smaller and smaller as you sort of move through the system in terms of court-ordered supervision or kids in foster care. Last year, for example, 87% of children removed on an emergency basis were black or Latino. Almost half of kids actually were black. So there is immense bias at play. It could be, you know, and the city knows this. ACS has rolled out implicit bias training, and its staff is mostly people of color. But there is structural racism at play. There is racism just in the practices and sort of principles that we are all subscribing to. You know, I spoke to a researcher, her name is Jessica Price, about this. She actually was a child protective worker before she went into academic life studying this issue. And she, you know, did not mince words about this. She says, culturally, the norms and standards around good parenting come from a very white point of view, and they don't take into account persistent poverty. They don't take into account systemic racism that families encounter in the world. So this is the system that we have, and definitely the practice that we have in place are sort of reinforcing it. Parents have described a very punishing system when they're involved with, when they become involved with ACS, that ACS is sort of, again, I think in the name of child safety, really nitpicking parents, trying to find something, trying to make sure that kids are safe at home by just searching and searching. And parents described a feeling of that they're looking for things that just aren't there. And so there's just this heavy surveillance that families are under.
And on the racism of that, or the implicit bias of that, if some people hear what you just described and think, well, the whole premise is that this is a condition of poverty and it's the black and Latino families who are overwhelmingly disproportionately in those situations, and most of the caseworkers are people of color, you said, then why where does the bias come in? How does it get demonstrated? And how do they train against it, since you said they're doing implicit bias training?
Well, it comes also from outside the agency in terms of reporting of these issues. I mean, certainly poverty plays a large role. But there are also issues unrelated to poverty that are widespread in the population, like drug use or mental health issues, domestic violence. But it's not white families that are under scrutiny and involved in this system. It is mostly poor black and brown families that are.
So what can change? What would be the best outcome from your series?
I think, in general, I'm not sure that anyone, I think first of all, we have to start from the baseline, and I believe this, that everyone really does want what's in the best interest of children. I think that, you know, as that same researcher that I spoke with, Jessica Price, she said that there has been such a focus on the idea of child safety at the expense of family welfare, that really should be called family welfare instead of child welfare, where the focus is on preserving families and helping families. Because, as she said, what children really want is for their parents to be okay. And it is in the best interest of children to keep them at home. Actually, there is research that shows that children fare better when they're at home, even in homes with maltreatment, that they fare better at home when they're with their parents and they get support.
WNYC reporter for crime and policing, Yasmeen Khan. Her multi-part story is called Family Separation in Our Midst. Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Bill McKibben joins us next. Stay with us.